Nell Lyson is the first woman ever to be commissioned to write a play for Shakespeare's Globe. Bedlam deals with the treatment of the insane in the 18th century during the gin epidemic, but it manages to include a good deal of humour and plenty of music between the episodes of bloodletting, blistering and, well, Bedlam. Nell Lyson is a novelist and writer for radio as well as for the theatre, and her play Comfort Me with Apples won awards in 2005. My name is Heather Neal. Nell is with me here now at the Globe to talk about her career, mainly about Bedlam. But before we start on that, I have to ask you this because so many people are amazed by it. Nell, you once made a bonfire of all your early novels, didn't you, in the garden? Three novels you'd written, complete works.
Yeah, three novels. I let one escape the bonfire, and I don't know where it is now, actually. I've probably lost it. Yes, it's something that seemed so obvious to do at the time, and people react very strongly to it. I mean, I think I'd got to a stage with writing where a lot of my apprenticeship was over, and it had been really, really tough. I'd had two young children and I was working and living outside London, very isolated from other writers. And I think I probably just wanted to draw some kind of line and just say, that's over, I'm not going to go back to that place. And I think it was a quality thing as well, to do with maybe that I wasn't content with those things that I'd written. And for me, I found it quite agonising to have them round. And I think sometimes when you're hanging on to things, it's actually not that good, it's better to move on. So I did it in a radical way. I actually burnt a huge amount of stuff that day. I lit a bonfire and just sort of said, right, that's it. I did it, I hadn't planned it, actually. I burnt all my university stuff. I probably burnt 10 years worth of work and thinking and just sort of carried it down in great piles. And it was really liberating. And in fact, I did it again recently with some other stuff. But I've usually got copies that I keep now, so I do burn some old drafts and things. But it's just something liberating about letting go and not looking back. I think always looking forward, and it makes you braver to look forward.
Well, you had to be brave to do your latest play. But we should say that you did write a novel which was long listed for the Orange Prize, Black Dirt. So one succeeded after all that.
Yeah, there were two. I've written two. I got a two-book deal from Picador, and I'm supposed to be delivering the beginning of another novel, but I've been waylaid by plays.
Well, the first of those, well, not the first play, but the first one we're going to talk about is Comfort Me with Apples, which won you an awards in 2005, and it's about the fraught relationship within our country family. The country's close to your heart, isn't it? I mean, it's what is happening to the country is close to your heart. Is that where that play came from?
I don't think it came from wanting to engage with the politics so much. I think that was a sort of byproduct in a way. It came from, that's where I come from, that is who I am. You know, I was brought up in a small market town, but Glastonbury, on the edge of the Somerset Levels. And then we moved when I was age 12, which I think is a really, you know, it's on the sort of cusp of adolescence, very important time. Moved to a small farming village, it wasn't like those farming villages where you have a lord of the manor. It was a very rough and ready dairy farming place with small farms. It was quite unusual. It was known as a sort of real rough, old-fashioned farming village. We moved there and I got very, very involved with all the farms and all the people there and absolutely loved it. I spent a few really informative years there. Spent a lot of time in and out of all the farms. When I was young, there were 14 farms in the village. And in fact, in the Second World War, there'd been sort of 23, I think it was. I found out at one point. Now there is one fully functioning farm and one sort of semi-functioning farm. So we're talking about something as radical as the end of mining. But because there's no, I mean, this is the sort of political aspect, because there's no union base with farming and it's traditionally a right-wing occupation, you know, they're usually Tory voters, there's been no protest and nobody's really noticed what's happening. And I think sometimes we don't see these things that are under our nose in our country. I think if we saw sort of the decimation of farming in another country, we might be a little bit more engaged with it.
Mm. How did you find that urban people took to this? I mean, you said just before we started that you'd like to write more about the country, but it's difficult to get people to engage with it, is it?
I think so. I don't quite understand it, if I'm honest. I mean, I think if you wrote an Irish play set in sort of rural Ireland, you'd be absolutely fine. And I think if you do it in England, for some reason the audiences don't really come. I think they had this problem with Harvest at the Royal Court, I heard on the grapevine anyway, that it is difficult to get an audience in. And I would like to write some more plays, sets. It's the dialogue of my ear from when I was a child growing up, and I would like to write some more. But I'll probably wait until I'm pretty sure that I can try and get an audience in somehow or get some more humour in. I don't know. I don't know how I'll do it, but I do have things I still want to write about, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it is to do with my imagination, the forming of your imagination and where that's formed. And I've always felt as someone who is an outsider to London and all of that. You know, I did grow up in this very old thatched cottage in the middle of all these farms.
Mm. Well, you had to use your imagination then, even more than most, to get to 18th century London during the gin epidemic. And how did you find the language for that? I mean, you say that the language of the country of your childhood is what is most nearly in your head for writing purposes. Was it difficult to find another language?
I think if you steep yourself in the research enough, that the language starts to stick to you and you start to pick it up like a sort of colour from a palette. And I chose purposefully not to write a big serious play about it. I wanted to steal some things from Restoration comedies, which I'd read and knew about and seen. So there was the language of those, and some of the language of sort of panto really as well, you know, sort of that kind of drama. So it was a mixture of lots of different things. But the research, I think if you steep yourself in research, you begin to absorb it. Your brain does start to take it all in.
Yes. Well, you said you wanted to write a funny play. Well, madness and fun don't usually go together, but you've managed to reconcile them. Was that a challenge?
Yeah, I think I've been working with some quite vulnerable people for quite a few years now. I work as writer in residence with a group of recovering addicts who've had a lot of issues with sort of mental health and things. And I've become more and more comfortable with it, that actually we laugh so much that I know that it is possible to do that without causing offence. So I knew that it was possible to do that, and I knew it was possible to write a funny play. And I think that if you write for the Globe, you have to at some point address this relationship between the writer and the audience, and to build up a warm relationship. And it was very much a play written for the audience, for the Globe. So that's sort of the choices that I went down, yeah.
Right. And I think you've said that your experience of writing for radio was particularly helpful for writing for the Globe as well. Well, what was that about?
Yeah, I think that's to do with, because you don't have big sets at the Globe. You know, you have little things and you can bring some things on and you can do some dressing, but essentially you don't have sets. So that you put a lot of the description and setting up all the scenes into the actual language, into the lines of dialogue. And that's the same as radio, where you're actually painting pictures in the listener's head. So I think there's a similarity there.
Mm.
And the way that you build up the scenes is something to do with that as well.
Your research involved going to the modern Bethlehem Hospital, didn't it? And you've talked to patients there, I think, and a particular doctor.
Yeah, there was a forensic psychiatrist there, Tim McInerney, Dr. Tim McInerney. And I worked with him and went to see his patients a couple of times and talked to them. And they were great, actually, very generous, talked very openly about what it is like to be there, what it is like to have been that ill, and all of that. And, I talked to them about the humour as well and said I wanted to make it a funny play. Actually, they came to see it, the first one of the previews. They came to see it and they were really, really pleased and loved the humour. They said that they were glad that was all in there. So, yeah.
Oh, that's good. You said, I think, too, that Hogarth was an inspiration. You started thinking that this might be a good period to write about when you looked at Rake's Progress, is that right?
Yeah, it's the Rake's Progress. It's the images of being admitted into Bethlehem. And yeah, that was definitely a jumping off point. I mean, I think it's a lot of writers do that. You can have visual stimulus and you can have, you know, music as well. Sometimes music does it, but I think with that, the images, the Hogarth images definitely helped get me going.
Yes, there's the one where Tom Rakewell is taken into Bedlam, which is full of characters who you might have had in your mind when you were inventing your own.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you could just take those amazing engravings. He was extraordinary, Hogarth, wasn't he? Absolutely extraordinary. And gives you such an insight into what life was really like, actually. It was a very brutal time, the 18th century.
Yes, and the one, the gin alley as well, that was particularly important, wasn't it?
Yeah, the gin alley versus beer alley, because, of course, people had drunk beer. I mean, I knew this from writing about the countryside as well, and Come For Me With Apples, that people used to drink beer and cider, pints and pints and pints, all the labourers all day long, because the water wasn't safe to drink. So they drank beer and cider, but of course, you know, they were drinking pints of very weak beer and cider, and then they just exchanged it for gin, so it was catastrophic. They didn't really realise about differences in proof of alcohol.
Yeah. Well, one of your main characters is a gin seller, played by Emma Smith, who's absolutely amazing, and everyone's taken her to their hearts, I think. And she's one of the main characters, but you have personal stories going on. There's a girl from the country who we follow. But sometimes people were taken back, weren't they, to the country when they'd come to London and went into a place like Bedlam, and then were sort of rescued. Is that right? And were looked after?
Well, people from the countryside would have come up to Bethlehem. I mean, there were very few asylums then, actually, very few. So if you were in the countryside and you really needed to go somewhere, your parish would have paid for you to go, you know, for you to go there, and then someone would have had to come pick you up when it was time for you to leave. Most people stayed in Bethlehem for about a year, unless you were incurable. And sometimes you got onto the incurable ward, but more often than not, you were kicked out, really.
The treatment seemed pretty brutal to us, didn't they? But apart from the whole business of visiting and people coming to look at you, what were the main ways they tried to treat?
Yeah, they didn't have much to offer, to be honest. I mean, I think they really were working in the dark, so they had to go at bleeding, which, of course, all came from the notion of humus, that you had an imbalance and that they had to correct the balance. But basically, the philosophy was to sort of shock the body so that you would shock yourself out of that certain state and into another state. Whether any of it really worked, I mean, I think what's interesting is that sort of before medication, the mental illnesses had their organic pattern. So if you were bipolar, you would have sort of, you know, moved in and out of states. Whereas now we do that through chemicals, you know, we use chemicals in that way. But I think there were a lot of people who were desperately trying to find ways to help people. It's very distressing, very distressing.
And ideas for this were beginning to change at just the time you're writing about, which is mid-18th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, mid-18th century. That was just the very beginning. I mean, it was still pre-psychiatry, but people were just starting to say, well, actually, we could be a little bit more gentle, a little bit more careful with these people and a bit kinder. Mm. You know, there was a feeling before that if you were mad, that you just didn't count.
Mm. It's amazing that visiting was still, for people who saw visiting an insane asylum as entertainment, it was still going on well into the 18th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was 1770 they finally stopped it, which was really, you know, the time when things became more compassionate. But yeah, visitors, and it was like 2,000 a day. Free access to all these patients. Completely free access.
You know, and they paid?
Yeah, they paid, and the money went towards keeping this asylum going.
Mm. You obviously done a good deal of research of the period and of treatments of the period, but you haven't used any actual people, have you?
No, I chose not to. I mean, I think when I was looking at the material, there were two plays to be written. One was a very factual play that took the real characters and focused very much on these two men and, you know, the conflicts and the way that they were working. And I don't think my strength is in that kind of big factual play. I don't think that's what interests me, and it wasn't what I wanted to do for the Globe. I wanted to do something else for me as well, which was to sort of, you know, maybe, I don't know, it just wasn't the right option for me. It seemed right for me to actually allow myself my imagination.
Well, but we do still get the different points of view about how to treat madness presented by two different characters who might just be a bit like two real characters.
Yeah, we do, but by renaming people and sort of snipping away at history, you can then sort of go away and have some fun. And I wanted the play to be fun, actually. I wanted there to be lots of music and laughter.
Yes, well, you've mentioned the music. I think you should say something about your research for that, because there's a lot of wonderful music in it, and it's very beautifully done.
The music is beautifully done by Ollie Fox. I think it's fantastic, actually, and the cast sings so nicely. The music, I wanted the music to be in there from the very first day that I conceived the play, and I went to Cecil Sharp House, which is the folk music library, and found... I knew that there'd been this craze in the 17th and 18th century for songs about mental health and Bedlam. There'd been a huge craze. Just this, you know, Restoration comedy, they often mention Bedlam. It was sort of embedded in all that kind of theatre. So I found all these songs. In fact, we couldn't even include them all. You know, there were some that I had to cut out. We had so many. And a couple of drinking songs as well. So, yeah.
Yes, and at least one is quite filthy.
Yeah, there were some really filthy songs. Yeah, there's some amazing stuff. I mean, all those kind of folk songs. I love all that folk tradition. Yeah.
And in fact, your musicians are part of the cast, aren't they? They are, as it were, licensed Bedlamites, which was actually what happened, wasn't it? Some of them were allowed to go out under license to make music.
Yeah, just like selling the Big Issue now, so that they had, I think they wore a star or something and a special uniform, and people knew that they were Bedlamites, that they'd been to Bedlam and were a sort of worthy cause for charity.
Well, what are you working on now? You're having a little break between all sorts of projects, and you're just thinking, is that right?
Yeah, I've got to rewrite a play that's opening a theatre festival in Newfoundland, or Newfoundland as we pronounce it, next year, and I'm just going to do another draft of that, and that will be on in, I think, June in Newfoundland, which is an amazing country, an extraordinary place. So that's got to be finished, and there's a workshop at the Royal Court, but sort of new writing things, you know, starting new projects. I'm just having a little think.
But you must have had to write Bedlam very fast. You must have been under some pressure to do that.
Yeah, I was actually, yeah. It had to be turned around very quickly, yeah. So it's quite nice not to have that pressure at the moment.
Yes, but at least you do have the advantage of a big space and a big cast when it does and is finished.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was fantastic. I think writing a bigger play for a bigger cast was really brilliant, and I'm so pleased I sort of took the challenge. Because I think with playwrights now, we just don't do that. I mean, I'd only ever written for five, I suppose, and a smaller theatre space. I had never tried that big dynamic. So for me, I mean, I think for any playwright taking it on now, unless you have a background, I suppose if you have a background in, I don't know, drama, but I never studied drama. So maybe you could write a play for a lot of people, but you just don't get the chance. And playwriting's sort of getting tighter and tighter, I think, contemporary playwriting. So I think it was brilliant to put a bomb under that and just sort of explode it. And, gosh, I've learned so much from doing that, how you fill a space and what it takes to fill a space, you know, how many stories how many balls you have to throw in the air to juggle with.
So I think is it 16 characters?
Yeah, there are 24 people on stage, including musicians and supernumeraries. So I think that's just been invaluable.
And the relationship with the audience here is very particular as well. Were you thinking of that as well while you were working? Because you had been here to see plays before, hadn't you?
Yeah, I think for me, working for the audience here was the absolute number one. That's what I was trying to work with. And I love that direct relationship between the stage and the audience at the Globe. I love it as an audience member. So that was absolutely in my mind the entire time I was writing. Yeah.
Well, it's still possible to see Bedlam a few more times, but you'll have to hurry. When does it finish?
Oh, 1st of October.
Yes. So hurry. But I wonder if it might be put on anywhere else. It's so particular to this space, isn't it? That's what happens with plays that are written for here, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't worried about that. I just thought, let's rise to the challenge and have a go at writing for that amazing space. I mean, it is just a brilliant theatre, absolutely brilliant theatre. And I don't regret it. It's just been fantastic.
Thanks very much, Nell.